Joining us today are Steve Kagan and Mary Kelsey. Steve Kagan is a self-employed documentary photographer and former assistant professor of photography at the Mason Gross School of the Arts at Rutgers University. Mary Kelsey is a painter and graphic artist whose work addresses human activity and the natural environment. Her art has been exhibited in New York, Boston, Cleveland, and other cities, and published in book, map, and illustration formats. Trained in anthropology as well as art, she was the recipient of a Fulbright grant to pursue artwork in Central American rainforest communities. She lives in Cleveland, Ohio. Mary and Steve are Cleveland-based artists working together on a mining project which breaks with journalism or traditional documentary efforts. The mining project grows out of their long engagement as artists and as activists. Steve and Mary have exhibited and published both imagery and text articles about Latin America, the rainforest, and the struggles for self-determination, local autonomy, and the defense of traditional culture. Their imagery has been used by communities in resistance. Steve has been working in the area of El Choco, Colombia, for 10 years and has developed a network of friendships and professional relationships in institutions and communities among professionals and rank-and-file men and women. He has done a great deal of photography in the area and has already begun to work on mining as a theme. Steve's article on gold mining in El Choco will be published by Revista, the journal of the David Rockefeller Center for Latin American Studies. Meanwhile, Mary has done work that visually explores relationships between people and their environment. Painting and drawings from her work in Latin American rainforests have been exhibited in several cities and publications. Among their numerous awards and recognitions, Mary has a Fulbright Fellowship and Steve has had two, all to carry out their work in Latin America. You can view Steve and Mary's work at www.stevekagan, that's one word, Steve Kagan with a C, .com, or www.marykelsey.com. Welcome, Steve Kagan and Mary Kelsey. Good of you to be with us.
Good of you to have us.
Okay, let's start with Mary. Hey, Mary, where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Cleveland, in Beechwood.
What brings you to this stage of this kind of artistic activism?
Well, I started out with a project in Central America, because actually my own imagery led me to that. I was interested in forests and in the rainforest, and the more I learned about it, the more I realized it's not about the forest so much as it is about the people who live in and around the forest, and that is what I went to look at, literally, some years ago when I had that Fulbright grant. And then getting to know Steve, because we had similar interests in Latin America and in the interactions of communities with their environments, I became interested in what he's doing, and he invited me to come along on this mining expedition.
Yeah, but when you grew up, were you, well, left of center? Were you somebody who was concerned about people and their struggles?
I think I did inherit that from my family, yes.
And how so? I mean, what did your family bring to it?
Well, I think my family, I think I was brought up to be aware of people outside of our culture, outside of our comfort zone, and to not necessarily be active on their behalf, but to know that they are there and that we are not the only ones.
What did they do for a living, Mary?
My dad was involved in finance, and my mother raised five kids and was very active in literacy.
And we'll go over to Steve Kagan, who I've known for a good deal of my life. Steve, remind us all what it is that made you a social activist.
Well, you know, I think the key elements were, first of all, that I came from a politically progressive family, but also that the first 12 years of my life, I lived in very poor conditions in New York City in public housing projects, and learned pretty much firsthand, because my neighbors tended to be African Americans and Latin Americans, I saw firsthand the effects of discrimination, you know? And I had the good fortune to have parents who didn't try to get me to memorize the truth, but tried to get me to see that there were values, human values, that we could act on, actually, in our lives. And so I think that was the background for all of this, and exactly how I came to photography as the way of expressing it and connecting photography with activism, that's a very long and complex story.
Well, I want to go there. But first I want to stay with your childhood a little bit. You were a smart kid, I remember that. Did you go to Bronx Science?
I went to Bronx Science. That's right. Bronx High School of Science.
Right. And I do remember that you were a political activist in a great deal of the struggles of the time. So
that's right.
So
that's
it's
right.
Sort of natural that you graduated to this. So let me go where you just suggested, Steve Kagan, and that is to photography. I mean, I know you went on the marches and did all of that, but what makes photography a worthwhile enterprise when it comes to social activism?
It's a good question, and I think there are two elements at least, probably many more than two elements. But one, of course, is that photography is a great medium for communicating, for documenting and communicating aspects of particularly what I'm interested in, which is people's daily life struggles, daily life resistance. You know, I go to these areas where there's great combats and, you know, armed struggles and so forth, and I'm not a war photographer. I'm not a conflict photographer. I don't do any of that sort of stuff. But I look at the lives of the people who I think are quite heroic, you know, who in the midst of all of this pressure and all of these of this turmoil, prepare their kids for school every day, try to find work every day, try to continue to have a, you know, sort of a dignified life. And I think photography is a great medium for communicating about people like that. But there's another thing that happens that's also very important for me, is that being in the environment as a photographer, not as someone who represents non-government organizations or even government organizations, but not someone with a lot of financial resources, but rather someone who comes to understand what the situation of the people is. Photography is a great medium for me for relating to people. And these days, you know, in digital photography, it's even better because people can see what you're doing right away. You can show them the results, and you can use the photography as one of the foundations of the relationship that you have with the people. So for me, it works very well.
So the question is, what's going on down there? What about this particular struggle? Can somebody sort of set the stage for us?
So El Chocó is an area in the Pacific of Colombia, right under Panama, if people can appreciate that. It's a rainforest area. It's an area where for thousands of years, indigenous people have lived, mostly people of the Mbera cultures. And for 500 years, there's been a very strong Afro-Colombian population who are the descendants of slaves that the Spanish brought to mine gold. So gold mining has always been part of what has gone on in this particular area. It's an area where people have lived very scattered in small villages, mostly along rivers and along swamps, and very few roads, very few means of communication in the way we normally think of this. Now, in this setting, people's livelihood was farming, hunting, fishing, a little bit of cutting down trees to make their houses, and then a little bit of panning for gold in the rivers and in the streams to provide some cash. People essentially have lived traditionally outside of the cash economy, but they use the gold to buy the things that they can't make themselves, cloth, tools, stuff like that, right? But what's happened in the last 10, 15 years or so is that with the increase in the price of gold, it has become economically viable for people to make big investments in machinery to mine in areas that have very small amounts of gold. And so what we have in El Chocó now is scores of big backhoes that are digging big holes in the rainforest, doing real environmental damage, which the panning for gold never did before.
What do you mean big holes?
Holes that are maybe 100 feet deep and maybe a quarter of a mile wide or something like that.
That's a big hole.
Yeah, big holes, or maybe an eighth of a mile wide, or, you know. But the thing is, of course, that these are holes that can't be repaired because the rainforest is, in fact, a very delicate environment. And some biologists have described the rainforest as a desert with a few trees on top of it. So as soon as you dig that hole, you're putting a challenge to the forest to recover that it's not going to be able to satisfy for thousands and thousands of years. And eventually, there's a tipping point, eventually the forest will start simply to disappear as a result. It's very significant. But on top of that, the people in the villages say, now wait a second, if these guys bring these machines, they must know there's a lot of gold there. So the men who have the machines, and they are all men, dig these holes, and then they say to the people, in the areas that we're done with these machines, you can come in and use your traditional panning methods in those areas. And so people go there, and in order to do that, they abandon everything else they've done. So they now no longer farm, they no longer hunt, they no longer fish, and in many cases, they no longer even live in the villages that they used to live in. And so this form of mechanized gold mining is actually distorting, not only is it damaging the forest, but it's distorting the traditional cultures and actually doing a lot of damage to the traditional cultures of the area and to the traditional economy of the area. This is on top of the fact that this is one of the arenas of armed conflict between guerrillas, what are called paramilitaries, and government forces. And the gold mining gets all wrapped up in that, too, as all these forces look for ways of making money.
Steve Kagan, could you just sort of dissect all of that for us and tell us how that works out?
Sure. The way it works out is this. The guerrillas, we used to refer to them as left-wing guerrillas because they had very strong politics. And we used to call the paramilitaries the right-wing paramilitaries. But today, I think that the politics aren't very strong on either side. They're essentially armed commercial groups. You know, they're armed bandits, if you want to say that. So one of the things they do is they would both say they tax the mines. We would say they extort money out of the mines. So they start having an economic interest in expanding this kind of mining because they, through the force of arms, are able to get money from the owners of the mines. That means that, but also that those people in the communities who see all this as destructive and who raise their voices and say, well, wait a second, do we really want our communities, our forests to be torn up by these mines, are now in conflict with people with guns who don't want them to be saying that. So there's a way in which the mining and the armed struggle sort of reinforce each other. And it makes the situation even more complicated and more dangerous for the people.
Now, have you and Mary ever come face to face with the, for want of a better word, the thugs on either side?
Well, I have not come face to face with them, but I've been in places, especially in Guatemala, where they had been there or they were near. And in the work I've done, I've always been working with local groups. And it's in their interest to protect those people who are coming as witnesses for their cause.
I'm sorry, I don't understand that.
They're going to try very hard to make sure that no harm comes to me or to anyone in my position who's there to witness what they're doing.
I get it.
So I did not feel personally in danger, though I was warned to be careful. And I must say that in situations like that, it's really handy to be able to make drawings instead of photographs because I can remember things and draw them afterwards. Mm. The camera's inside my head, so there's no film to pull out and or camera to smash. It didn't come to that, but
well, does that put you in some competition? I can't resist with Steve, who's the photographer.
Oh, this is an important theme. We like that question. That's not a hard question, Alan, because I think we see our work as complementary as opposed to in competition.
Yeah.
But let me answer your first question. In Colombia, I have had the good fortune of never encountering any of these people directly. I know that I've been in the same villages where they've been, but I haven't had any encounters with them, right, on either side, which is very nice. And it's partially because the people I work with down there are very protective of me. The people I work with are from and that Mary and I will both be working with when we go down together this summer, are from the Catholic diocese in the area, the federations of the communities of the area, and some other sort of local grassroots organizations. They're very protective of us. And so they say, you know, Steve, we wanted you to go to San Marino, but you can't go to San Marino because the guerrillas were there a couple of days ago. And so, you know, they know what's going on. So that helps. But previously, when I was working in Central America, like when Mary was, I was very much in contact with the guerrilla forces. And I saw them and with the army. And I was in El Salvador at least once arrested and once detained by the army. So, I've had my little encounters. Fortunately, nothing very serious.
Which brings up the question of the government itself. There used to be, of course, far more, sort of fratricide in Colombia than there is, it's my understanding, now. So, now you have gold mining. We do know that corruption rears its head a lot in various countries. What's going on there?
Corruption is very serious in Colombia. It's a very serious problem. In El Chocó in particular, the area that we're going to, the last seven governors of, it's called a department, they're not a province or state, but the last seven governors are either in jail or on trial right now. So seven. So that's pretty serious.
Why is that? If the government is corrupt, why are they putting the governors in jail?
Because there's also a conflict between the national government and the local government. The situation is awfully complex, and much of it has to do with racism, because this is an area that is predominantly Afro-Colombian.
Interesting.
And then after Afro-Colombians, who are about 85% of the population, the next largest group are indigenous people. And so the mestizo or white people who run the national government are actually quite a minority in El Chocó. And there's a generations-long history of kind of racist abandonment of the area and conflict between local government and the national government.
We're talking to Steve Kagan and Mary Kelsey, and they're spending time and giving a lot of attention to gold mining, which is a bit of a crisis in Colombia, and sort of parsing the whole situation. So I guess there's always the question of whether or not, Steve and Mary, they want you there. You just said that the folks who live there do want you and they protect you. But how can we be sure of that?
Well, That's a good question. The evidence that I have of that is that we're able to do the work. If the local people, and I say the local people are divided. You know, people are divided. We don't just lump everybody into some category and say this is who they are. But if the local people, as a rule, did not want us there, we wouldn't be able to do any work, right? Hmm.
And that brings up the question of exactly what are we doing there and how do we relate to these local communities?
Great question.
Fact
answer
is,
it.
I'm sorry?
Great question. Answer it.
Yeah. Well, the fact is that we are really there in a sort of accompanying role, not only as witnesses, but we are there, we accompany them. And the fact of our presence and the work that we do, photos that Steve makes, the drawings that I make, is maybe a form of validation. It is a form of just acknowledging they are there, they have a struggle, and we are there to see it.
Can you just use the word validation? I'm having a little trouble with it. Can you help me with what it means?
Well, I have found in my work that it's very validating for people that they are struggling in their struggle, validating their effort, their being, their existence, which may have all kinds of problems. For me to come in from somewhere else, from a place they know to be much wealthier, much stronger, having much more power than they do, and to find it worthwhile just to be with them, to sit with them, to make images of what they're doing in their daily lives. There is a kind of power in that I definitely think creates a connection and a strength for them and helps us do our work.
Are there any of the folks, if I'm running a big gold mining company and I don't want trouble, I try to make sure that even at the lowest level, somebody gets something out of this. So there must be somebody over there who's employed as a result of this who may resent what you're doing there.
Absolutely. That's the case. And as I said before, it's very important not to kind of create easy stereotypes of who the people are. And, you know, everybody at one economic level thinks the same way and everybody on the other level thinks the other way. It just isn't true, right? The situation that we have right now in the area that we're talking about in Colombia is not so much great big companies, but they're sort of medium-sized companies. And it'll be a couple of guys who managed to get a bank loan to buy a couple of, when I say backhoes, I mean, these are very big machines, right? They employ 15 or 20 people. And of the 15 or 20 people they employ, the ones who are mechanics or otherwise technically advanced people are not from the area. So they end up employing 5 or 6 people from the area. So it's not much of an employment option. But the people who they allow to pan in the pits once they're done with them, they allow the people to go and do the artisanal mining there, start feeling very loyal to them, saying, well, these guys are giving us this great opportunity that we didn't have before. Whether, in fact, it's a really great economic opportunity or not requires some much higher level economic analysis than I'm able to do, but it's questionable. But still, just like people throughout the world, you know, move into a city, move into a slum, and look back at the village where they had a good diet, good air, you know, their kids were secure and everything, and say, oh, no, I'll never go back there. The same thing happens here. People are not going to go back. So there is division among the people. There's division on that. What there isn't division on is the next thing that's coming, which refers to or is responsive to an earlier question, Alan. The national government is not that interested in what we're looking at now, the localized, relatively localized mechanized miners. They want to bring in the big transnational mining companies to open up huge, huge mines that will displace communities entirely. And that, the communities are pretty much, you know, 95% united against that. There are a few people who honestly have sort of sold out to these companies, and they get kicked out of the leadership of the communities as a result. I've seen this happen. I've actually been an eyewitness to the people being kicked off of the boards of the federations of the communities because of their relationship with these international companies. But the national government, that's their position. They want these companies to come in, as is happening throughout the world.
Another aspect of this is that we both understand that the situation is complex, and it can't really be boiled down to there's one bad guy, and here are the bad guys, and here are the good guys. And so it's important to both of us to not take sides in that sense, but just to depict what we see, to avoid that oversimplification of the problem.
Well, but due respect to both of you, it seems clear to me that you think there's a problem and that you have an orientation.
Yes, we have an orientation. We try not to have a bias. I mean, we would interview and make images of owners of this equipment as well as people doing the old-fashioned hand panning.
I love the fact that both of you are artists, graphic artists, photographer. This is something we don't see much of. We see people write books, write magazine articles, explain all of this. But this is a path that, while, you know, it's practiced, we don't see much of it making a major impact. Do you expect to make that kind of impact?
We understand that we cannot be focused on results. We hope that our work helps, but we don't have the illusion that single-handedly we're going to change any situation. We're just contributing what we can.
And I think, Alan, that you're right. You don't see too much of this kind of work, either in photography or in graphic art or in painting, but you used to see a lot more of it. And the world has shifted a little bit, and the art world has shifted a little bit. And I think, certainly for myself, and I think this is true for Mary as well, we are happy and proud of being connected to a tradition that has existed from the very beginning in art, that part of the function of visual art is to help people deal with the world, help ourselves deal with the world to start out with, and then help people in general deal with the world. But you're right, it's not the mainstream of what's going on in the visual arts, certainly in this country anymore.
Okay, so historically, you refer to the fact that there's lots of precedent for this. For those of us who may be a little slow, can you give us some of those precedents?
If you think about painting, think about Goya, for instance.
Sure.
Think about Picasso.
Sure.
Think, you know, lots of people think about the Thomas Hart Benton in the United States or other people who did work whose purpose was not only aesthetically important and valuable work, although it certainly always was a motive, but also the motive of getting people to think about the world by looking at the work and getting themselves to think about the world by creating the work. And then in photography, of course, the great movements of documentary photography, in which the United States was a leader among other countries, but was one of the important countries from the 1890s through, I would say, through the Second World War.
But if we see one, think about this, Steve, of course, I mean, I have to tell you, but if we see one photograph out of Vietnam and we all had to judge what it would be the guy with the gun, you know, pointed at the guy's head kneeling.
Or the, Eddie Adams, or the naked, took that picture.
Yes, or the naked child, you know.
Right, the Nicot picture,
yeah.
Right.
And can have tremendous impact that a lot of words can't. But would it make sense for you guys to be working with somebody who uses words as opposed to cameras and graphic arts?
In this case, our words, we expect them to come from the interviews with the people. The words are going to be the things that people tell us about their experiences and their reactions.
How are you publishing that?
Yeah, we are casting about for a publisher right now. Any publishers who might be interested in this work, we'd love to hear from you. we're reaching out to publishers.
Right.
We do have one commitment from a major art center in Florida to do a big show that will be Mary's drawings, my photographs, artifacts that we're going to bring back, tools, and then texts on the walls, things people have said to us about what their situation is. And we hope to do more exhibits and to do more publications.
Interesting. So you've both taught. What is the teaching aspect of this? What's the potential for teaching younger people? I mean, I knew Mason Gross, by the way, quite well, where you taught at Rutgers. What do you think you can bring to our college-age graduate students in this country?
Well, there are at least two groups of people that we think about when we think about teaching using these materials. One is the people who are also going to be artists or visual communicators. Those are two areas, I suppose, that overlap, right? And one of the main things I want to teach them by example, and also by preaching, if you want to put it that way, is the necessity for artists and for visual workers and visual communicators to take responsibility for what they're doing.
Mm.
Not because we think that individually we're going to change the world, but because if we don't take responsibility for what we're doing, that is, if we don't think about, well, what is the image I'm producing, how accurate is it, how significant is it about the people and the situation that I've seen, then we just produce work willy-nilly that may or may not help us understand the world, right? But then the other thing, I think, is to teach literally the content. You know, I've been invited and have been doing some speaking at some college campuses around this area, around in Ohio, about the situation in Colombia, and people learn, you know, and people ask questions. And, you know, these kids ask really good questions. They want to know. They're curious. The world is out there. They know that. And they know that you start talking and they think, well, I've never heard of any of this before. So they're eager to hear.
Mary,
and I also think that having images with which to present our project to students is going to be very helpful to them to see that there's not just one way of approaching things. You mentioned Words are very effective, but also photographs, also drawings.
Sure.
There are many ways to approach enlarging our understanding of the world.
Well, Mary, I wonder if you would be kind enough to sort of tell us how it works. In other words, you see something and you draw it or you paint it. And how do you make those decisions? I mean, before when you guys were sort of saying that much of what you do is sort of neutral in that you're observers, the moment any journalist decides to write about something or paint something or photograph something, obviously they're making some kind of a statement. So tell us how you've worked in the past, how this happens.
Well, what I've done in the past is usually I've allied myself with usually a non-governmental organization that was doing some project. I mean, in the case of the work I did in Central America, my focus was really on rainforest conservation and how communities interacted and affected that and how that happened through a community. So obviously, I was connected with organizations who were working in the communities. So they had to bring me in. I wouldn't have been accepted any place by myself. So really, essentially, I took all of my direction from them.
Wait, but they had an orientation, right? In other words,
yes.
How neutral can you be when you're working for an organization that wants to, for example, preserve the rainforest as opposed to, and I can make an argument for not preserving the rainforest, even though I don't believe it. So, I mean,
well, in fact, that's a really good question. I'll give you an example from a project in Guatemala,
sure.
In the lowland forest area of Guatemala, not the highlands, but the lowlands, which was actually close to Belize. And this was a very remote community. They brought me, the agricultural extensionist who was working with them, wanted me to come there. They brought me there. It was a long, really rugged drive in a Jeep over roads that barely existed. We got to this community. And for the community, they particularly wanted my help in some training they were doing for the community with health issues because they were so remote they couldn't get out to get to the hospital, particularly when babies were born. So that was a community that was kind of displaced from the highlands originally, and they were trying to make it in this lowland area. They were cutting the forest, but the interest of the extensionists was to help them have better agricultural techniques and improve their animal and agricultural husbandry so that they would have to cut less forest so they could have better yields on the land that they already had cleared.
Okay, but where does the art come into it?
Well, I was there to make images, and they wanted me to do a bunch of specific things for them. And then I also made as many drawings as I could of all the ways that the agricultural extensionists were working with people and trying to educate them in different ways of doing their agriculture, doing their farming. But the interesting thing was the people of the village, what they wanted more than anything was a drawing of a bridge over the river.
Mm.
They did not have a bridge over the river. They wanted to raise money to build a real bridge, because every year the river floods. And when the river is flooded, no woman who is pregnant and is going to have a difficult childbirth can get out to get to the hospital. So I made them the drawing. You know, I made them that, and I don't know what they did with it. But that's an example. I go in, I'm brought in, and there's someone who wants me to do something, but there are all kinds of other things I can do while I'm there. And there is, as you know, it is not possible to be totally objective. That's
I do know that,
realistic.
Yes.
Right.
You know, Alan, I want to go back to your
sure.
to your question about neutrality. I wouldn't use the word neutral. I mean, you used it a couple of times.
Sure.
I don't think, at least for me, the goal isn't to be neutral. I'm not neutral. I'm on the side of these communities. I was listening to a couple of priests from the Catholic diocese there, and someone was saying, well, if you don't support the government and you don't support the guerrillas and you don't support the paramilitaries, all of which is true, then you're neutral. And one of these priests says, no, we're not neutral. We're on the side of the communities. I don't think that neutrality is a serious achievable objective. But what is a serious achievable objective is to be open and to be honest. And if you're open and honest, you look at the situation and you say, everybody doesn't agree here. There are some disagreements, and I have to show them. For instance, people live in different ways, and some people live better than other people. And people who are being sort of victimized, if you want, by the policies aren't just victims. They also have their families, and they have their celebrations, and they have their joys. And I can't come in and say, this is what I understand the truth to be, but I have to learn what the truth is from my relationship with the people.
Okay, but the destruction, for example, to both of you, this question goes, the premise that you enter, and you've talked about it in the beginning of the interview, is the destruction of the rainforest. Now, that's a premise. We had major forests in this country. We cut them down, you know, and look what's happened. And we come down there and we say, don't do this. And that is our operational hypothesis. Don't allow this. I mean, there are always two sides, aren't there? There's somebody saying,
absolutely,
yeah,
there are. Absolutely.
How dare you?
We actually cannot come in and say, don't do this. We can't come from that point of view. We can only come from the point of view, we are here to witness what you are doing, what the issues are, what the struggles are, what you're trying to do. And there is also the opposite. There's always a countervailing point of view, which is we need to cut this down. We need to do this because it will bring in income.
Sure.
And that's valid also. We have to try to depict both sides.
Steve, you want to check in on that one? Because you were talking about the
Peace Corps. I think I'm a little bit more partisan here on this because I feel like I identify with those people within the community who are trying to resist the destruction of the forest. So I feel like I'm there to serve them, but I am there to learn. It's very important. And I mean, I've just heard all through my activist life, I've heard people saying, you know, well, everybody in the community except the very wealthy believe this. And that's just not true. Believe X, whatever it may be. That's not true. People are divided and situations are complex. And so we have to be able to reflect that complexity. So I'm not saying that I don't go to these areas with values. And one of my values is the importance of conservation, the conservation of the natural environment. But I'm saying I'm not going there to impose my sense of what has to be done or the way in which it has to be done or anything of that nature. I'm going there to learn what the issues are for the people, how the people come down on these issues, and what I can show about the dignity. Well, dignity is a big word for me in this, you know, the dignity of the lives of the people and their attempts to maintain their culture and their attempts to move forward both economically and socially.
Well, help me with the word dignity. That's an interesting concept. Perhaps you could expand on it a little bit.
Well, for instance, for me, dignity means the ability to feel that you're in control of your life and that your kids are going to... A lot of this has to do with raising families, you know. People are very centered on their families. People in the villages are very centered on their families. So a lot of what I think of as dignity has to do with being able to have this sense of having power over your own life and having the ability to live at peace with your neighbors, to see your kids grow up feeling confident, feeling strong, feeling happy, being healthy, feeling that you're not... sort of your life isn't dependent on the whims of other people, and particularly the capricious whims of other people. You know, I think dignity is all connected to those kinds of issues for me.
Steve and Mary, just to remind everybody, we're talking to Steve Kagan and Mary Kelsey. They're both artists. One's a photographer, one's a painter and a graphic artist. And, you know, they're here with us talking about their work in El Choco in Colombia and the gold mining, which threatens to disrupt the rainforest. So people understand more when they hear a story. And when you guys come home from an adventure like this, you almost always have a story. It's a story about a chief who talked to you or a moment of danger. I'd love it if each of you would tell me a story. Steve?
Here's an interesting story, and this is about dignity. A few years ago, I went with friends to witness a meeting, an assembly of various communities, Afro-Colombian communities of this area, this particular area that I was working in El Chocó. And in this village where the meeting happened to take place, the people came from various villages, but the meeting took place in one village. 3 years earlier, there had been a terrible conflict between guerrillas and paramilitaries and the people, and there had been one death from a villager who was not involved in the conflict, was killed. And the people fled their village, and they went to the city, the nearby city, which is the capital of the area, and stayed there for a year or so, and then went back to the village. Right? That was 3 years earlier than the meeting I was attending. 3 months earlier than the meeting, the same thing had happened, where some of the armed actors, as they call them, had taken a couple of guys out of a canoe and taken them to the edge of the village and shot them.
Mm-hmm.
It was really horrible. And so my friend, a priest who's down there, was telling me, and then he repeated to the people in the meeting. He says, you know, I came here 3 months ago when this happened, and none of you at this meeting said a word. Nobody in the meeting, not a single person said a single word. You just sat there silently, which is not what goes on here. People tell stories. People argue that people are very voluble. But I know why, because you were terrified and you had every reason to be. You just had these deaths. Why didn't you leave? You left the first time. Why didn't you leave the second time? And they two guys stood up and they said, you know, we can answer that. And there are two reasons. First is that the experience of leaving was not a good one for us. When we went to the city, we were very unhappy. We're not city people. We're really rural people, and we're village people, and we wanted to be in our village. It was an unpleasant experience. But much more important, what's happened in the intervening 3 years is that you and people like you have come here and talked to us about the fact that we have a right to stay here and that these armed groups don't have a right to push us out and that it's possible for us to decide that we're going to stay here no matter what the people with the guns want. Right? And so we decided to stay.
That may be post hoc prop hoc, however. In other words...
No. I don't think so. I think this is actually the case that what had happened, and this made a big impact on me, what had happened was the constant visits by people from the diocese and from people from outside the area and so forth to sit down with them. There were people from the United Nations who came and talked to them. There were people, but mostly Colombians, right, but from other areas in Colombia, sat down with them and talked about this, was that they developed, this is about dignity, they developed a sense that, yes, it's possible for me to stand up and say, no, I'm not going to be pushed away. I was very impressed by that. Now, after 2 days, we were going to leave this meeting. The meeting was going to go on another couple of days more, but we had other things we had to leave.
But wait. Were you taking pictures at that point?
Oh, you bet.
Because, I mean, you know, that's what you do. You're a photographer.
That's what I do.
Telling your story, right.
That's what I do. I take pictures. Now, I tell you, and this is very important, if I go to, whether it's a meeting or a family or a guy on the street or a lady on the street, I just don't take pictures. I explain to them who I am, why I'm taking the pictures, what my motives are, how the pictures might be used, and is it okay with you if I do this? And some people say no. And if they say no, I may say, yeah, but don't you think it's a good idea, you know, whatever. But if they say no, it's no, and I don't do it. So in this case, this was a meeting. So I get up in the front, and I explain this to everybody. And then I say, so I'm asking your permission to do this. And then they say, nothing. And I say, no, I mean it. I'm actually really asking your permission. So please say yes or no. And then people say, oh, yes. And one person says, don't take my picture. And I say, okay, fine, whatever.
And why do they tell you not to take the picture? Because they're afraid of repercussions?
Because they're afraid. Yeah, they're afraid of repercussions. Otherwise, or sometimes, you know, it's happened here too. They say, I'm in my work clothes. Take a picture when I'm dressed up.
Yeah.
You know, or something like that.
Sure.
And then what I say to people is, yeah, but you know, you're in your work clothes because you're struggling. This is what you do. You are really working hard to have a good life for you and your family. And that's why you're in work clothes now. So don't you think that's worth people knowing about that? And some people say, oh, I see what you mean. And other people say, yeah, maybe, but I don't want you to take a picture like this.
Mary, what's your story?
Well, I'll pick up on that theme of people not wanting their photograph taken when they aren't dressed up, because I ran into that a lot. I did carry a camera to take sort of as a form of sketching almost. I didn't use it much, but I remember once asking someone, can I make a picture of you? And they didn't really understand it. They said, no, I'm not dressed up. And I said, no, I'm just going to draw. He said, oh, okay, fine. And that happened to be a fisherman who was some fishermen who were going out fixing their nets, and they would go out and get some fish. Those particular pictures, those drawings, I was requested to make by the organization that I was partnering with in that village, because that was a traditional form of economic activity for them, which unfortunately was going to be threatened by developing tourism in that area. And I think they were hoping to strengthen their traditional economies. And they asked me specifically to make those images. But it reminds me of another village, actually in a different country, in Guatemala, where I was also brought in by extension workers, and they wanted me to see some commerce that was going on where people were taking rice, which had come from Guatemala, and ferrying it across a river into Mexico, actually, for sale. So I remember specifically standing there, and I remember two things about that village. One was starting to make drawings of this, and within minutes, there must have been 25 people standing around me watching me make
that
drawing.
What do you make of that?
They had not seen that before. It was very new to them. They were fascinated that I could create that image with a simple pen on paper. They were absolutely fascinated. But the kicker to the story for me was that at the same place, almost the same location, I made some drawings of some women in the kitchen, washing dishes and making tortillas, and the women were absolutely tickled. They thought it was hilarious that their activity was worthwhile making an image of. And that's really the kicker of the story, because that's mm-hmm. the power of making those kind of images.
That gets back to dignity again. Yeah. Mary, you were trained as an anthropologist. There are those of us who read Margaret Mead, Samoa, and the rest of it early on. How do you see what you're doing compared to what earlier anthropologists have done?
Oh, that's an interesting question. There's so much controversy right now in the field about different ways of doing anthropology. And I guess for me, the anthropological training helps me as an artist have a point of view that is a little more open-minded maybe than it might be otherwise. It helps me step back and try to see as many aspects of what I'm depicting as I can without making a judgment on them. So essentially, it's very much field anthropology as opposed to archaeology or more quantitative methods of study and culture.
Interesting. And the painting and the graphic arts and the anthropology, how does that fit together?
Well, as I say, the anthropology is how I approach it. It gives me the background to approach people in a different culture and try to be open-minded and broad-minded and see what I'm looking at as opposed to just seeing it from the outside, try to come closer into the inside. But making a handmade image is a choice that has come to mean for me that I take the time to do that. And people really respond to me taking the time. And what two things happen. One is that there is a quality of trust that develops because they can see what I'm doing, first of all. It doesn't require complex or expensive equipment. They can see it. And the fact that I am sitting down to draw a woman who's washing dishes, which is absolutely the most mundane activity she can imagine, in some subtle way, maybe not even conscious, I think, sort of says to that woman, I find your activity interesting and worthwhile. And I think people, all I know is it creates goodwill, and that enables me to make more images.
Well, now, that's interesting. And Steve, you go down into this place. It's poor and the rest of it. You have a camera. It's, as you mentioned before, there's been a digital revolution. Can you print your stuff and show it to them?
I can't print it, but I can show it to them on the screen.
On the screen, yeah.
Yeah, I don't have the capacity to print there. But I, for one thing, I can show it to them on the little screens on the back of the camera, and they're very interested in that. You know, they'd like to see it. They also are curious about why I'm doing it, and they ask a lot about why I'm doing it, you know? And so that's important.
Do you both speak the language? I'm sorry, do you both speak Spanish?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay,
yeah.
Go ahead. I'm sorry, I just wanted
now,
to...
Now, actually, many, in the area that we're going to in El Chocó, there are a lot of people who don't speak Spanish. The indigenous people, and particularly the women and kids, mostly speak Embera. They don't speak Spanish, so I have to get the fathers and husbands to translate frequently. I can't resist telling you a story about that, because recently I was up at a village that I've been to a couple of times. That's a 6 to 8 hour walk up a mountainside to get to this village, right? This is an Embera village. It had been displaced by the Spanish. I mean, you know, so it's really, they've been there for a long time. And there are three elders of the village. And I became friendly with them, and I would talk to them every morning. He said to me, once they said, in your country, is it like it is here in Colombia? I'm going to sort of translate this a little bit, but they said, is it like here in Colombia? And I said, well, in what respect? I said, well, you know, in the respect that everyone is either an Indian or a white person. Said, well, not exactly, but all right. You know, and they said, well, you come from the United States, right? Right. And that's really far away, right? So here's a question we have. In your country, we heard that you eat people. I said, no, we don't eat people. I said, actually, I have some, you know, a lot of questions about what we do often and criticism of what we do, but actually, I don't think we eat people. And it turned out that this was a widespread view within this community and within this area, you know, of the forest, that people from that cannibalism was widely practiced in the United States.
Where did that come from?
I have no idea where it came from, except I was talking with a woman who was a cook, just a cook, you know, not educated, not. And she said to me, you know, I heard that too when I was a kid. My father told me that. But what I think is that when we don't know people, when we see people, she said, you know, my father, the first time he saw an Afro-Colombian guy come up here, he ran away out of fear. And I think that when we don't know people, we make up these things about them because it gives us a way of understanding them or thinking that we understand them. That was a pretty interesting response from a person who never took an anthropology course, you know?
Yeah.
And, it was a great response. So, and it's about how, in fact, people do demand a certain kind of willingness on the part of visitors or people like us, you know, who are trying to work with them, to be open to them and to be understanding and to be sharing. It's not just that we want to learn about them, but they want to learn about us. We're curious to them. We're strange, you know. We're funny, actually funny, and so they want to hear from us. And I think that one of the things that makes this work possible, whether it's drawing or whether it's photography or whether it's interviewing people and writing down or recording what they say, you know, is a sense that's shared between us and the people we're talking to, that we're not there to tell them what to do. An awful lot of people come there to tell them what to do. We're there to learn from them and to share our experiences with them as well, so that a sense, a kind of mutuality of interest, you know, of an exchange that actually can be beneficial to both sides, is a really important part of the relationship. And I think it's critical for us to think, it is for me, and Mary and I have discussed this a lot, that we share this, that this work starts with our sense that we want to have a relationship with the people. We want to be working with the people. We want to be helping if we can help in their struggles and in their, you know, in their work and in their activities. So being a photographer, for me in this sense, doesn't start with learning how to use the camera. It starts with learning how to listen to people.
Okay, but, you know, I mean, you talked about how some of your friends were priests down there.
Right.
Obviously, the church could, word for word, say what you just said, you know, about listening, being on the side of the people, but having very strong views as to what's right and what's wrong, and bringing that to those people. So I'm always suspicious that that people have values, and even though they deny them, they have them. The church certainly has them.
But it's a good parallel. It's actually a very good parallel, Alan, because I can look at these people in this particular diocese, and I've said to them, you know, is this diocese typical of the, there are 80-odd dioceses, I don't know exactly how many in Colombia. Is this typical of the Diocese of Colombia? And they say, oh, no, there's one other that's like this, right? That there are priests, and there have been in this area, priests who come in and preach to people about how they're supposed to behave. And then there are priests who come in. And this same is true for nuns, and the same is true for lay workers, and the same is true up to the bishop, who come in and say, I'm from another place. I need to hear what you have to say. So, for instance, the recently retired bishop of the area was sent to the area by Rome to be the bishop precisely because it was pretty clear to everybody that he was a conservative and that Rome was tired of all this human rights activism in the diocese and so forth. And what he did was he went there and he spent the first 2 years of his role as bishop traveling around. The priest told me about this. He didn't. But traveling around to the communities in the rural areas and to the neighborhoods, the poor neighborhoods in the city, and just asking people to tell him about their lives. And after the end of those 2 years, he decided he would support all this human rights activity instead of suppressing it. So, yes, I think we go there with values. I have values. I have ideas. But it doesn't mean you can go there with ideas and values and impose them, or you can go to any place to your neighbor with ideas and values and engage in an exchange with people to try to figure out to what extent you can learn from them and you can respond to what they want and you can respond to their needs and that your values can reinforce that relationship.
Now,
that,
how do you guys
that
get?
That to me is the goal.
I'm sorry, Steve and yeah. Mary. How do you guys get money to do what you're doing?
That is a tough one. We're essentially our friends and family are helping, and we ourselves are financing this particular trip, and we're hoping to get some grant money as well.
Well, congratulations! I had no idea that you were independently wealthy, able to.
We are not at all. We are not at all. We hope we break even.
Right.
Steve is more the master of that than I am. I'll let him answer that.
Go ahead.
The truth is that it's a constant and difficult struggle to raise money.
But there are foundations that help. I see that on your Vita.
Occasionally.
Or that have.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And we hope to tap into some of that.
Right, right.
And we will.
And
I
that
mean, the truth is we needed to make this trip this year, and so we're going ahead with it. And we just are going ahead in the belief that we will find support.
Every once in a while when I give a talk or have an exhibit or put something online, someone will respond and say, I hope when you publish your book and you make a lot of money from your book that you're going to share this money with the communities. Yeah. And I say, you must have some information that I don't have about getting this book published and then making money from it. You know, but if yes, we'd like to make money from this. To be honest, in my situation, I think Mary's is not that dissimilar. I spend a lot of time just doing different little jobs to put together enough money to be able to do what I consider my most important work.
This is not the only work we do. We couldn't afford to at this point.
Yeah, this is a passion, though.
It's a passion.
Yes.
It's a passion, yes.
So how long will you spend at it before you move on to something else?
Well, it's going to be a couple of years more of work on this, for sure.
Yeah. Well, we'll spend only a couple of months in Colombia at this particular trip, but there's a lot more work to do afterwards.
And so
Making exhibitions for the people there that they can use.
And trying to find that publisher who wants to publish this book about this stuff.
Who knows? Who's listening?
We hope, you know.
The last question. The people who've been listening to it now, why should they care?
The first reason they should care is because we're talking about humanity. And, you know, it's whether it's Marcus Aurelius or Margaret Mead, it's that nothing human is alien to me. I'm interested in humanity and I'm interested in the struggles of communities and I'm interested in preserving the planet and I'm interested in preserving the forest and I'm interested in the things that people confront and how they confront them, because that's part of being human. I think that's the first reason. But then we've talked about this a lot. These are issues that affect us. Here in Ohio, you know, we're confronting the issue of fracking. And, you know, hydraulic fracking.
We got that here in New York, too.
Right. And, you know, and we're concerned about.
And there is a parallel between the two things, what you're talking about.
Including the parallel that people get divided. And some people think this is going to be the salvation of our community. And other people think this is going to be the death of our community.
And greed can enter into it and all the rest.
Well, yeah.
And the other part is we really hope that we're going to be able to make images that will be really interesting and attractive to people. They'll want to look at them. So we're really not starting from the part of them that understands it cognitively. We're trying to come at this from an aesthetic point of view.
Well, Steve Kagan and Mary Kelsey, two artists who have gone to Colombia and taken a look at some of the destruction of the rainforest and have created art. From that, I want to congratulate you, and I want to thank you for spending all this time with us today. It was very nice of you. Very quickly, Steve and Mary, why don't you give us your websites?
Well, first of all, the website for our project, that's the most important one.
Okay.
So that's www.elchocomining. It's ELCHOCO, elchocomining, one word, .net. Okay? And from there, you can get to both of our websites and to other important links that we have for you there.
Well, Steve and Mary, thank you so much for spending all that time. Steve Kagan and Mary Kelsey have been our guests, and it's just great to hear from you.
Thanks for having us, Alan.
Thanks.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.